What's good and welcome to the Hockey Mailbag, the first sports podcast run by you, the listeners. I'm your host, Brandon Rewicki, and each episode follows a simple format. You send me whatever hockey-related questions are on your mind, and I provide the answers. If you want to be a part of the podcast, just send your questions to hockeymailbag@gmail.com or to me on Twitter at Brandon_Rewicki. All right, busy times in the NHL and for me personally, so we'll get right into it here. Just a bit of a heads up, though, in the midst of a family vacation throughout the week. So I've actually recorded this episode a bit earlier. It was Sunday, February 2nd. So if I've missed some shocking trades, because that's apparently the sports world in 2025, we'll get to them in next week's episode. But for now, we'll do a little bit of current stuff. Also, you guys came to play. A lot of unreal questions about years past in the NHL. So you guys brought it. I appreciate that. But we'll keep things current to kick things off. And Jack has the honors for today's episode. No question master Tyson today as well. He'll be back next week. But Jack asks, did both Vancouver and the Rangers screw up the Miller trade? Rangers for giving up a first when they're out of the playoff picture, and Van for immediately trading that good pick for Pettersson. Interesting perspective on the deal, Jack. I guess I'll start with the, for me, maybe the easy one of the two, and that would be the Vancouver Canucks. I do not believe they screwed up the JT Miller trade. Well, in the sense, in terms, I guess, how you kind of couched it there. Maybe they waited a bit too long. Maybe they could have extracted more value having done it a bit earlier and not had this black cloud surrounding the team all season. That part, you could make a good case they probably didn't handle that well. But when you're talking about the return itself, what it really ends up being is Philip Chytil, Marcus Pettersson, Drew O'Connor, Victor Mancini, and on top of it, Vancouver gets out of the Danton Heinen and the Desharnais contract. So they're able to shed about $4 million in salary there with those two that didn't really have a piece of the future for them there. And they're still bringing in some decent players to kind of come fill the void and make a bit of a push for the wildcard spot this year. So look, the Chytil and a first and Mancini for JT Miller is not in a completely contextualist vacuum is a bad return, right? But this was the hand they were dealt, and maybe part of it was forced on them by themselves. But at the very least, you're getting a young guy that can be, I think, a third line center for you, maybe second if he explodes. But I think, it's fair to say at this point, Chytil better suited for that third line spot. But what it really does if you're Vancouver is, one, it gives you the opportunity to see how Elias Pettersson plays in the last 30 games of this year. I don't think they will, and I don't think they should trade him right now, right? Because if he's able to play like the 100-point guy he's capable of, then there's no need to trade him because that's one of the most valuable assets in hockey. But if he's this funky Elias Pettersson of late, and he puts up 15 points in the final 25 games or something like that, well, then you kind of get a sense and maybe you have to reshift the priorities for your franchise at that point, right? But Pettersson's a good player, and I think they're going to re-sign him. I don't think there's any issue of him going to the market there. And Vancouver's done well before in doing a similar trade where they flipped their first, I think it was the Bo Horvat trade, right? Where they flipped the first and got Hronek to play beside Quinn Hughes. That's worked out well for them. I think Pettersson's a good ad. I like what Vancouver did with the crappy hand that they were dealt here. The Rangers, on the other hand, look, this is what happens when you have a desperate GM at the helms because he doesn't care about future pay, right? Like, he doesn't care about future assets. He doesn't care if JT Miller isn't a good fit in the room 2 years down the road. It's just, can we get into the playoffs this season and can I save my job? That's pretty much it for Chris Drury. And he nailed that part of it in the sense of he got the best player available, realistically. So I having said that, though, I mean, look, it's not a lottery-protected pick, but a top 13, I think, protected pick. I think for the Rangers, best-case scenario here is that they actually fall out of the playoff race this year. They can keep what might be close to a top 10 pick. And with the talent they have there, they rebound next year. and they're giving up a late 2026 first round pick for JT Miller. That's best case scenario there, but I don't know if that's ultimately how it's going to play out here. Did the Rangers screw it up? I don't know if they screwed it up because they didn't give up a ton, but at the same time, is it a move that puts you over the top as a cup contender? It seems like the problems with the New York Rangers are much more deep-rooted than just we need another center in here because Mika Zibanejad can't carry the mail. So, I don't know about that. But I think Vancouver fans should be pretty happy with how this played out here. And they could just, it's just over with. That's the main thing. Like, it's just done with. We could actually watch and maybe enjoy hockey for the first time in 4 months. So, thanks for the question to kick us off there, Jack. We move on. Of course, a few other moves in the NHL these past few days. And Razor's up next. And Razor asks, isn't it way too early for the Flames to be buyers? Well, Razor, let me answer your question two ways. Yes, it is too early for the Flames to be buyers at this point in their rebuild. But I don't think the trade they made with Philadelphia is a buyer's move per se. You know, ultimately what Calgary ended up doing was, I think what a lot of teams in similar situations should do is you give up some of the draft capital that you amass to see if a couple young talented players can rejuvenate their career. And it's almost like found money for you. Yeah, you know, like I don't think they necessarily went out and wanted to buy and, you know, hey, let's bring some guys in here to help this team make a playoff push. It's just maybe a little bit of both, but I think more so the fact that an opportunity comes up. You ship out two guys and Kuzmenko and Pelche that just weren't going to be a part of your future, and you bring in two guys that might. That it costs you a second-round pick, right? I get it from Calgary's side. I don't have much faith, you know, as a Flyers fan. I don't have much faith that Frost and Farabee are going to be a big part of a contending team, but for a second round pick and with the capital that the Calgary Flames have amassed here, it's worth a shot, right? You know, worst case, it didn't work out. Best case, you get maybe a second, third line center and a solid second line winger in Joel Farabee. So I don't mind the move there. I don't think it means the Flames are buyers. The one thing I will say about Calgary quickly though, is for a rebuilding team, I know it's early, but they don't really have a lot of high-end young talent. Like, it's kind of remarkable. You look at their roster right now. They only have three guys 23 and under making big-time contributions this year. And that's Coronado, Connor Zary, and, of course, Dustin Wolf. Now, that's a big part of the rebuild is hitting on him by the looks of things. But, man, that Flames team needs a lot of young talent to come in. And maybe that's why you take a chance on Frost and Farabee there, because they can fit your group for the next 4 or 5 years potentially. But I know Calgary's got a couple first-round picks the next 2 years, which is great, but that's a team that they might need to... I just wonder a little bit if they're not getting younger enough, right? Like if maybe just... I don't mind teams having veterans kind of pave the way for the youngsters, but maybe too old in Calgary? I don't know. We'll keep an eye on that as it goes. But thanks for the question there, Razor. We move on. One more NHL current trade-related question here. And that comes from at PB541. And PB asks, ooh, I like this one. How many GMs would you choose to run your team ahead of Mike Greer right now? I got to eat a little bit of pie on this one. A little bit of crow. I wasn't a huge fan of Mike Greer's early moves as a GM in San Jose. I didn't know if he was getting full value for some of the deals that he was making, but I was wrong on that one. He's had himself quite the glow up over the last few years here. Helps too when you pick Macklin Celebrini first overall, and he looks like, you know, a borderline, I hate to use the buzzword, but borderline generational player perhaps. But Mike, I don't think there's 10 guys I would take ahead of him. I'll say that. I guess there's two things. Again, I hate to do the two things then, but there's two things to a lot of these questions. Mike Greer has done a tremendous job in taking over a old, expensive Sharks team and giving them a breath of life and a chance to contend much sooner than any of us would have anticipated. He has done remarkable work there. He's cleaned out the cap. I mean, to get rid of Carlson, Hurdle, Meyer, even though Meyer's, you know, a good player, right? But they weren't going to be a part of the next contending team in San Jose. And so he was able to get a ton of assets back there. And now you've built a bit of a core where you have Celebrini, Will Smith, Askarov, who's been great in the A, sometimes in the NHL when he gets a shot. And then I guess Sam Dickinson would be the next one on the blue line there, right? So like there's, you can see the nucleus being built there. The only thing I'll say is this with GMs. It's really easy to tear down a team, right? Like it's not that difficult to ship out guys with the mandate of it's rebuild, youth. The difficult part is then molding them into an actual contending team. And that's where we'll really see if Mike Grier belongs with the heavy hitters at the top of the GM table. You know what I mean? Like he's done great work right now, but I don't want to put him top five. You can't put him top five just yet. But at the very least, Sharks fans have to be happy. Mike Grier is a smart, thoughtful dude who's making all the right moves right now. And I wouldn't mind seeing the Sharks get a little aggressive this offseason. Give some help to some of the young guys there. Maybe you do the rare double dip and you bring back Mikael Granlund. You pick up a first-round pick and he's gone for 2 months, comes right back in. Seems like a good fit there. But he's doing a tremendous job. There's not too many GMs for sure that I wouldn't mind running my team right now. Would love to see the Sharks get back into it too. But thanks for the question there, PB. One more trade one, actually. Rip City Rick, which is a tremendous handle, by the way. I was wondering if there would be a question about this, and Rip City Rick brought it for us here today. So I'm thankful for that. But he asks, what is the NHL equivalent of the Luka Doncic, Anthony Davis trade over the weekend? I mean, there isn't one, I guess, first off. At least historically, I don't think there's ever been a trade like this. I don't know if there's ever been a trade like this in any sport, to be honest with you. This was the single most shocked I've ever been at a trade coming through like this. Just because of the magnitude of the player and players being dealt, but also just the complete secrecy in which it happened. Like nobody knew it was coming. There's been guys move before, but whispers kind of floating around there. But this one just came out of left field. Just kind of making up comparables here. Like Quinn Hughes for Erik Karlsson or Roman Yossi. You know what I mean? Like, I don't even know. Zach Werenski for Roman Yossi, me? Like, I don't know. It's tough to kind of come up with one. I don't think there is one. But that was just a bonkers Saturday night to see that come out of nowhere. The last time I can remember being shocked like that would be, what was it, the summer of 2016 or 17, where you had Hall for Larson, Subban for Weber, and Stamkos staying in Tampa all happened in like 20 minutes. That's the last time I think kind of the hockey world of the sport, I can't even say the sports world, but like, you know what I'm saying, right? Where it's just like rocked with that kind of news. But man, I just feel bad for Mavs fans. That's all I can say. I know it's not a basketball podcast, but that's just rough stuff, boys. Sorry about that. But thanks for the question, Rip City Rick. Appreciate that. And now we shift over to some of your questions that are kind of more evergreen in tone here, which I kind of like. I wouldn't mind doing a few episodes like this where it's a little more like, hey, the boys and the girls are just sitting back, tipping back a couple of cold ones, and let's talk some puck here. Let's name some names. Let's think about some goals, stuff like that. I love that. So that's where we'll go for our next few questions here. And Gregory's up first. And Gregory says, who's your favorite player in each decade of the NHL? That is a fascinating little question there, Gregory. Oh, well, yeah, I guess it depends how far we want to go back. Do we do the 1940s? I know there's a lot of New Zealand fans out there, but to me, I'm more of a Mud Brunetow type of a guy. We don't have to go that far back. The only reason I know Mud Brunetow, by the way, for anybody that wants to stump their buddies on a trivia question, Mud Brunetow scored the OT winner in the longest game in NHL history. So keep that one in the back pocket for you guys there. Why don't we keep it to the, I mean, the seven, I've seen some, I'm obviously not that old, but I've seen some 70s games. So we'll keep it like 70s and we'll move up from there, which I think is fair. By the way, the NHL Network used to air classic games all the time, like classic Stanley Cup finals, and they never do that anymore. I don't know what the deal is there, but for me, 70s, pretty easy. It's lame, but this will be the only legend I'll, you know, Mount Rushmore legend I'll put on this list. But for me, 70s, Bobby Orr. I don't know if there'll ever be a player like him where he looked literally ashamed of himself for scoring some of the highlight reel goals that he did with the Bruins, where he'd go through the whole team, puck goes in the net, and head down. Oh, I shouldn't have done that. Poor guys over there. They're just trying their best. But yeah, there might never be another one like Bobby Orr. So that'll be my 70s pick. For the 80s, I love watching Danny Savard play. He's one of those. There's very few artists out there, like guys that kind of make it look artistic and poetic. And he was just a beautiful player, man. And he might have scored maybe the best goal in any NHL history. But I think I'll go Danny Savard with the 80s. I didn't want to put Cam Neely in there because to me, he's more 90s. You know, if you want to do that, I'll go Cam Neely. But I'll give Danny Savard some love. 90s, I would say like most, just about every 90s kid. Pavel Bure's pretty tough to beat. So I would say either Pavel Bure or Eric Lindros. Lindros might be the biggest what if in NHL history, right up there with some of the best in sports histories in terms of what does his career look like if he's able to stay off the injury wagon there. So those would be my 90s picks, as well as Peter Forsberg, my favorite player of all time. 2000s, that was an easy one for me, actually. Pavel Datsyuk. I mean, he's not the greatest player, obviously, in NHL history, but I think he's the only and one NHL player in NHL history. Like, the only one that has a legitimate and one style highlight reel tape. I mean, some of the stuff he did is just unfathomable. To me, he was like, he's your favorite player, right? Like, your favorite player loves watching Pavel Datsyuk. I could not get it. By the way, hot take, might be the Flyers fan talking to me, but I think mid to late 2000s Pavel Datsyuk was equal to Sidney Crosby at the time. Just saying. I don't know. That's just how I feel. I don't know if Datsyuk gets enough love for how crazy good he was. And that takes us to the 2010s. And this might be a bit of a left field pick there. But just because I saw this guy in person basically every single home game for about 7 or 8 years, I guess. But Dustin Byfuglien is my favorite player of the 2010s. There's some guys that you need to see live to really appreciate how special they are. You know, I think Connor McDavid speed, for example, you notice it on TV, but it's just different in person. Sidney Crosby's vision, for example, you can see the great passes, but when you actually watch it live, you're like, how are you possible? How does this exist? And to me, that was Dustin Byfuglien. I mean, when he was on, I don't know if there was a more physically complete player in that I can remember. Maybe in NHL history, to be honest with you. Like, to be 6'4", 6'5", he was listed at 260, honestly, probably closer to 280, 290 when he played, but biggest, strongest, fastest guy on the ice every time he hit the ice. Like, it's crazy. Like, it's not possible some of the stuff that he did. And when the Jets made their run to the West Final in 2018, he, as far as guys playing in the playoffs, he was the best player on the planet. I could not believe some of the stuff that he was able to do there. And I think the fact that he was kind of a gentle giant in nature probably kept a half dozen players alive in terms of avoiding his wrath. If he was Chris Pronger nasty, he would have been a whole different cat to handle there. But Buffett is best. There was very, very few players like him. So thanks for the question there, Gregory. Love that one. Great way to kick us off here on that foray down memory row. Next up is Joss. And Joss asks, who's the actual most underrated player in the NHL? No more Barkov or Slavin, for the love of God. Yeah, Alex Barkov being the most underrated player three or four separate seasons was, I just couldn't stand that, man. Like, when's he's winning Selkies and all this stuff? And you can't be underrated if you win awards. I thought long and hard about this one, actually, because it's tough. Like, to me, Jack Eichel's kind of underrated, because I think he's a top five centerman in the NHL. But is that the same as saying, like, a third liner is first line quality? Like, you know what I mean? Like, how do you kind of define levels of underratedness? I'll go with a guy that I don't think a lot of people watch or maybe know too much about, but is one hell of a player. And it's actually Alex Barkov's teammate. I'm going to go with Nico Mikkola as the most underrated player in the NHL. That whole cup run they had last year, I was just like, yes, they have Ekblad. Yes, they had Montour at the time and Gus Forsling. But you just watch this big dude that can skate like the wind. He, decent offense, too. Like, he wouldn't get power play time, but he'd chip in with a goal every now and then. He's a hell of a player. Like, he's really, really sturdy and steady for them. Plays 20 minutes a night. No power play time, but he's on pace for 30-plus points. That's a dude that I would have in my top four any day of the week. And I don't know if enough people know about him or kind of watch him closely, but if you watch a Panthers game coming up here, Nico Mikkola is a guy that I really, really enjoy watching. And I'll give him the nod for me for the most underrated player in the NHL today. We continue with the underrated theme here. Kate is up next. And Kate asks, who are your top three underrated goalies of the last 25 years? All right. Thanks, Kate. It's kind of sad that 25 years means 2000, not like, you know, 1991 or something like that. But nonetheless, top three underrated goalies since 2000. I love Marty Turco. I feel like Marty Turco doesn't get enough love for how dominant he was for a really long stretch of time in Dallas. And everybody says that, you know, Marty Brodeur kind of enforced the trapezoid amongst all of us here. And that's true to an extent. But Marty Turco might have been better at playing the puck than Marty Brodeur was. But Turco, I mean, you look at some of the years that he had in Dallas in the early 2000s there. I mean, one, he kind of allowed them to ship Eddie Belfour out early. But he was putting together 925, 921, 932 save percentage in three straight years there. Even a 913 playing 73 games. And then he had some pretty legendary playoff runs too as well, including a Stars run to the West Final. He was a hell of a goalie, man. I don't know if enough people give him credit for how strong he was for basically a decade for the Stars in the 2000s there. So Turco gets some love for me. Johan Hedberg was just like never a guy that would be a starting goalie, but you gotta have a hell of a backup every once in a while. And the Moose was that. And to play on as many teams as he did, and to give starting, you know, solid backup goaltending, and to do it, what was he, sub 6 feet? I got love for Johan Hedberg. And the final one, this might surprise you guys, but I'll die on this hill that Steve Mason actually had a pretty damn good NHL career. And I think he was a lot better than people give him credit for. They kind of just remember him falling off a cliff in Columbus, which, to be fair, he did. But, I mean, one, Rookie of the Year, almost won the Vezina, was nominated for, like, I think he finished top five in Hart Trophy voting that year. As a rookie, played 61 games. Couldn't really find it in Columbus, but he had some really, really good years in Philly too. And that's maybe where it's more so the underrated part of it comes from. But like a 917 save percentage, 928 save percentage, and then a 918 for Philly, three straight years there. He was a really good goalie, but it just he couldn't really capture that for a long period of time. But I don't know. I thought even when he was with the Flyers, he just never really got enough love because of how things fizzled out there in Columbus. But those would be three guys that I would mention there. So thanks for that one. Kate, We got two more to go, so let's pick it up here. Next up, at Trey33. I like that one. Trey asks, what's your best or favorite goal, hit, and save in NHL history? Very nice. Interesting. I want to talk about the hit one last, because this is the only one that I actually saw in person. Best goal, I would say, I mean, the Merrick Malik between the legs, come on. That might be the loudest I've ever screamed at a goal. And I'm like, I could care less about the Rangers or the Caps. But like, that might be the most surprised I've ever been at a goal. And I don't know if any, I don't know if anything will ever top that in terms of shock factor. I'm going to give some love to Rick Nash. Speaking of maybe underrated players, but Rick Nash had a beauty against, I think it was the Coyotes. Maybe you dock him points because it was against the Coyotes. I don't know. But he went, it was a one-on-two, and he goes forehand, backhand, through two guys, avoid the poke check, in and around the goalie, top shelf. I think that year, too, he scored a beauty for Canada against Finland. But I'll go with those two as my favorite or best goals that I can remember. Save? No doubt about it. Check this one on YouTube if you haven't seen it. I'm mind-blown every time I watch it. But Evgeny Nabokov for the Sharks against the Dallas Stars. It was a playoff game in Dallas. I think it ended up going to triple OT. And I think it was in double OT that he made the save. But it was this quick pass cross ice. And I think it was Brad Richards that shot. But it was a quick pass cross ice one-timer. Absolutely labeled it. And sometimes, you know, you see like a diving glove save, where it's more just luck, you know, like an element of luck, at least I should say, where like the puck just kind of hits them as opposed to them making a save, if that makes sense. But this one was where Nabokov somehow in the span of half a second goes post to post, kind of diving sort of glove save, and he's able to snag it before it goes bar down there. That I'm just blown away at that one every time I watch it. But my favorite or best hit that I've ever seen was actually in person. And surprise, surprise, it was the player that I mentioned a little bit earlier this episode. But it was Dustin Byfuglien. And it's the only time I've seen a hit live that I actually thought that a hit killed somebody. Dustin Byfuglien hit Mark Stone so effing hard. It was identical to a car crash. Like if you've ever seen or heard a car crash, that's what it sounded like. And the crazy thing was, it was so clean too. Like there was no headshot. It was just shoulder right to the chest. And it was a world of pain that Mark Stone, that's probably why he's been on LTIR for all these years. he's recovering from the buff hit. But if you haven't seen it, check it out. I remember it happening and just being like, he killed him. Like this is bad. And the crazy thing too is, my brother actually played with Mark Stone growing up. But Stone, I think, ended up missing the next three or four games. And the reason for his absence was body soreness. he didn't have like there was no broken bone. There was no crack this fracture. His body, it was like, I've been through a train wreck and I need a week off. I've never seen anything like it. So if you don't know what I'm talking about, give it a watch on YouTube. I'll never, ever, ever, ever forget the sound that hit made. But thanks for the question there, Trey. And finally, we wrap things up with Donnie. And Donnie asks, kind of a current one, I guess, but what's the excitement level for you for the Four Nations tourney? Donnie says, thought I'd be super pumped, but kind of just want the trade deadline. thanks for the question, Donnie. I kind of agree with you. Like I thought I'd be more jacked up for it, but I guess I'm kind of at the point now where it's like happy it's not an all-star game, but also it's not the Olympics, so I can't get that excited. Like, you know what I mean? Maybe it'll be different once we actually see these guys hit the ice and like you watch McDavid for the first time, like for me at least, Canadian, watch McDavid hit the ice for the first time for the American listeners here, like to see Matthews and Eichel and for them to have a chance to take the hockey throne as the number one nation in the hockey world. Maybe it's different once the games get underway, but I don't know. I'm just kind of mad about it right now. I don't think the NHL, surprise, surprise, has done a great job of marketing this. I'm actually going to Montreal. I didn't even know it was in Montreal. So I'm just kind of, yeah, I would say it's a big meh for me. Capital M-E-H. But I'm open to things changing in a couple weeks once this bad boy gets underway. But I will say this, I do want the deadline as well. So the quicker we can kind of get into this, the faster the madness will happen here. But thanks for the question there, Donnie. And that's where we will wrap things up today. Thank you guys so much for tuning in to another episode of the Hockey Mailbag. As always, really appreciate getting to hang out with you beauties here. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to be a part of the podcast, just send your questions to hockeymailbag@gmail.com or to me on Twitter at Brandon_Rewicki. We'll be back at it next week, Thursday morning, talking the latest in the NHL and the Four Nations Tournament. But until then, I'm your host, Brandon Rewicki, and we look forward to talking puck with you guys real soon.